This episode is brought to you by our sponsor, Ahe Wu from Falls Church, Virginia. Ahe is a loyal listener to our podcast. She believes that studying history is crucial for anyone who wants to make a positive contribution to society. She says it's important to study presidential history specifically because of the president's role in shaping our country's underlying principles and values. Ahe also admires Presidents George Washington and Franklin Roosevelt because she sees them as strong leaders during times of crisis, especially during times of war. Thanks, Ahe, for all your support. And now, on to our episode. Our guest today is Merrill Eisenhower Atwater, and I'm very excited to have him as our guest. We just did a series, a two-parter on President Eisenhower, and Merrill is the great-grandson of President Eisenhower, which is pretty great that I think you're probably the first relative of a president we've ever interviewed on this podcast, so this is a first. And you're also the CEO of People to People International. So, Merrill, I just wanted to thank you for joining us and just sharing, you know, your insights.
Well, you know what? Thank you for having me. It's absolutely an honor to be on this this podcast. This is one of my first podcasts I've ever been on, to be honest with you. So, kind of fun.
Okay, wonderful. Yeah. So, first of all, you know, it was great to study your great-grandfather and learn about his background. Obviously, we focused on him as a president during the Cold War, but also I really like the idea of having relatives of a president on just because it's a reminder that, well, presidents are people too. They have families like everyone else. They, you know, go through life just like everyone else. So, you know, I guess you probably have heard a lot of stories growing up and about President Eisenhower's background. And one of my favorite quotes of his is the quote where he says, "We were a poor family, but the glory of it was that we didn't the glory of America is that we didn't know about it." So what can you tell me about Eisenhower's just his family background and things that you've heard growing up?
Absolutely. So, you know, we were just talking about going down I-70. You actually passed the presidential library out there in the middle of Kansas in Abilene. The thing is that you got to remember when Eisenhower was born. So when he was born, it was 1890. He spent almost all, except for 3 years of his childhood in Abilene, Kansas, which is a unique situation by itself, right? Whenever he was younger, you had things like the Great Depression, you had, you know, the Dust Bowl, but a lot of that stuff happened after he left his house. The thing is, back then, rail was king, cattle was king out in the West, and things were a little bit different. His dad worked on the rail company and also worked at a creamery. His mom was a stay-at-home mom. The interesting thing about Ida Eisenhower, his mother, is that she actually came all the way from Virginia, all the way across the country by herself to Kansas, where she went to Lecompton and actually ended up getting a degree, which is unusual, a college degree, in fact, which is extremely rare for women, especially at that age. But, you know, just to be by herself, having no other support and doing it herself is pretty phenomenal. David and her met there. And when you're talking about poor, there's a saying that we say in Kansas that this person was from the wrong side of the tracks. And literally, there's a track in the middle of Abilene that divides the poor side with the wealthy side. And it is an absolute divisible line. When he was growing up, he used to do auditing jobs throughout his high school and earlier time. Everything from planting gardens to go sell extra food at the downtown to make ends meet to feeding. His mother used to make it, you know, 7 loaves of breads twice a week in order to feed all the kids. In addition to that, wrong side of the tracks also meant a lot of discrimination because you were poor. And it was interesting because there's this place called the Steely Mansion out there where he wasn't even allowed on the porch because he was so poor. And it was kind of interesting to see and learn about that as I was growing up as well. But really, back then, when you're talking about why it's so unique and different, the Midwestern values, especially back then, and even today, is a little different than the rest of the country. Things are a little slower out here. We take our time. We get things done. Our words are bond. You know, there's not a lot of tomfoolery that happens. But the most important things is the values that are instilled by his mother, really, not his father. His father was working on the rail, which means he went all over the country back and forth through his line. But that his mother actually is by far one of the greatest unwritten women in history. In fact, one time, it was 1945, she somehow got the Mother of the Year award by this group that oppressed people that did that. And she said, how are you so, you know, impressed with your son? And she goes, which one? Because they all ended up being, you know, multimillionaires, or they ended up being very successful in their fields. One was the one that did the worst was a pharmacist, for goodness sakes. Oh, wow. One of his brothers started as a janitor at Commerce Bank, which is a huge bank out here, and worked his way up all the way to senior vice president. And all of that was instilled by the educational value that the mother, who got a college degree by herself as a woman in the early 1900s, actually ended up putting all those things together and making a life very feasible for them.
It's very interesting because when you read about Eisenhower's life and his brothers, and they seem to have a very fascinating relationship. Were there four or five of them, I believe?
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Yeah. Five. And I know that I had been reading that one of them was actually roommates with President Truman in their youth.
That's true. That's right. True. Yeah. Absolutely. Which is kind of interesting if you think about it, especially later on, the dynamics between the President Truman and Ike as well. It's kind of interesting to see those dynamics that happen later on.
Yeah. And I know that
one funny thing also about that is that we actually are friends with the Trumans today.
Oh, great.
Clifton Truman is a good friend of ours, and we see him three or four times a year.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Isn't that fun?
Yeah. And so, I mean, there's been much written about the relationship between Eisenhower and Truman. Did they know each other going back to when his brother was, roommates with him?
Well, you got to remember back then, Ike would have been probably just a very junior officer in the Army. So there's no way that they would have known each other.
Sure.
But Truman's relationship with Ike stemmed all the way from the really falling out was really whenever Truman dropped the atomic weapons. And then eventually during Korea, my grandfather was in Korea and he was an officer on the front lines. He actually ended up getting a Bronze Star. But Truman actually pulled him away from his men's to come to the inauguration. And that was one of the devastating moments of their relationship.
Oh, wow. Okay. I've always heard about it being their relationship going south with regards to when McCarthy was criticizing George Marshall and Truman was upset that Eisenhower didn't, come to his defense and so on. So that's very interesting.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Well, see, so if you think of it that way, that's one way to put it. But really, you got to remember that Ike never voted one time until he voted for himself. And the reason why is because his commander in chief was his boss and he knew it and he did not care one way or the other. Maybe he didn't stay. He stayed out of the politics of that particular situation. But for the most part, the difference is that Ike, whenever he was elected in 52, Truman didn't care. He brought John home anyways. And that was kind of an interesting concept by itself.
Right. And one thing that kept coming up was Eisenhower's poker prowess. And that's something that I had read about. And it really adds a new layer. And it really goes well with later on where people talk about his nuclear brinksmanship and was he bluffing? Was he not bluffing? What have you heard about his poker prowess, basically?
That's actually kind of interesting. So he learned how to play poker from a very, very poor person, but he was poor at the time too, so it didn't really matter. He was a mountain man, a guy, his name was Tom, I believe, or Bob Davis, excuse me. And what would end up happening is that Ike was a pretty literate person at the time, continued to be all throughout his whole entire life. But this mountain man would come and beat into his head actually how to play poker, right? And it's kind of interesting whenever you start thinking about that, because It really starts talking about the strategic value of the thought process of doing it. So poker, most people play poker. When they think of poker, they think of it as a game of chance. You get a card, you either have a good card or a bad card, and you bet on that card. Well, he learned then that he was absolutely able to understand the probabilities of what was going on based on the odds. And so what it does is it actually changes the way that you think a little bit, right? So just like any other education, whenever you learn something new, you start thinking a different way. And this was no different. And in fact, I saw that question earlier and I asked my mom, I said, is it possible that he won Mimi's engagement ring, for example, through poker playing? And she said, it's very possible. It's very possible that that happened. I know for a fact that he won a jewelry box, a very nice jewelry box, in fact, that my aunt has to this day, which is kind of interesting.
Wow. Did he continue to play poker throughout, you know, his older age? I know that he basically, his superiors kind of told him to stop fleecing his colleagues, right?
Absolutely. So Ike was kind of interesting. So if I'm going to take it back just a little further before we start talking about that, Ike never saw combat during his whole entire time as a military officer. In World War I, he was actually pulled into different camps for training. So he would train different groups because of his ability to think exactly like what we're talking about. So with the poker and all those different things. But more importantly is that Ike was always an athlete. He was always a star. He was always someone that was working towards that. But he actually thought many, many times that he was going to be moved out of the military, you know, kicked out because he was not promotable in different ways. But poker itself is something that stayed with him for as long as I can, you know, you can remember. I believe he probably even was playing poker with Arnold Palmer, you know, and it wouldn't surprise me at all if he was on top of the White House when he was grilling out playing poker in a game of cards with his friends.
That's great. If they make another Eisenhower movie, I think they have to add that element to it.
Absolutely. You got to remember, it's the American dream, right? So think about it for a second. You have someone that literally is dirt poor, that doesn't have any means whatsoever, in the early turn of the century. So the next president of the United States could be listening to your podcast right now. Let's hope so, right? Because
that'd be great.
We want to inspire people all the time. That's the goal. So he literally pulled himself up out of the dirt and the muck on the wrong side of the tracks through education, being a great military leader, being a good person, and becoming the 34th president of the United States. That is literally, you could not write a book about it. And I don't think there's been a movie yet that has actually done it justice, because it is an American story. It is what we believe that we can all accomplish. And I hope we never lose that faith.
Yeah. One of the things that really struck me was how there were times in Eisenhower's life where he experienced a great deal of disappointment, and very relatable disappointment. Here's this young man who, when World War I breaks out, he wants to be part of the action and he has to stay home. And then it seems in other times his career stagnates, but it's like a setup for what's coming next. And I think that's something that so many people can relate to.
Absolutely. A great example. Sometimes I give a speech whenever I talk about Ike. I talk about overcoming adversity. So when he was 8 years old, he ended up cutting his right leg and contracting blood poisoning. The doctor wanted to amputate. It didn't amputate. Could have lost his career. He applied for Annapolis, didn't get into Annapolis because he was too old. He went ahead and applied to West Point, got in barely. You know, graduated middle of his class, went into the Army, finishing up. Couldn't get into command school because he had no actual combat experience. And General Fox back then said, well, why don't you switch your MOS to quartermaster? And so he switched over. He started as a tank commander, went to infantry, then moved over into quartermaster, went to command school, ended up placing first in his class, you know, in both aspects of it, and then went back into infantry again. And so it's kind of interesting when you talk about our careers and how we have to do things and shift and shape. It's no different from a farm kid from Abilene, Kansas.
Right. Now, what do you think about Eisenhower's background and his family life? How did that influence his leadership style throughout his career?
So Midwesterners, just in general, I always say that we are measured people. We tend to be very thoughtful whenever we do things. Sometimes we have tempers. Ike surely had a temper. There's no doubt about that. But for the most part, I think that his background, his importance to education and doing the right thing and making sure that you had the ideas and thought through things fully before you execute them, I think was one of those things that really shaped his career. You have Patton saying, you know, we need to go all the way into Russia. You have Montgomery sitting there saying, oh gosh, you know, I want to be the first. And Ike sitting there saying, guys, we need to work together. This is how we do it. This is the plan. This is the measurement. You know, World War II, during D-Day, he actually wrote a letter to my great grandmother saying that, you know, if anything goes wrong, it is my fault. He takes all responsibility on this, takes everything off everybody else. In fact, it was actually signed wrong. The date was wrong because he had so much pressure going on to him. And eventually, you know, on June 5th, postponed, June 6th, it happened. And it was an absolute amazing, amazing accomplishment when you think about it. But more importantly is that one of my favorite quotes that he says is that plans mean nothing, but planning means everything. Mm-hmm. And so the thought process of what will happen with this, what will happen with that, the fact that they made a fake harbor out of boats and pontoons and all of these things so that you could get supplies into France, all of those things played a major role. But all of that stuff stems from not only understanding what fair values are, having empathy, understanding what the next step would be. And I think that carried over into his presidency as well.
Right. Now, when you look at World War II, you read about Patton, you read about MacArthur and all the great military figures of that time, Bradley. I mean, you know, the list goes on, the class that the stars fell on, and as they say, and yet it was Eisenhower. And of course we have to say General Marshall, and yet it was Eisenhower who became the president among all of them. What about him was different from all the rest?
That's a great question. I don't think I've ever been asked that question before. The truth is that besides Bradley, think about the egos and the sense of I'm a warrior, I am important that went on during World War II. You have everything that was happening in the Japanese front, where no matter what was happening, I was the one that was important. Ike was called the best damn aide ever by MacArthur, but never given the credit of what he was able to do, his strategies. When the war started in 1939, Ike was a colonel. You know, by 1941, he was a two-star, actually planning out what was going to happen in Japan. And then was moved into the front, the European theater, which is interesting. All of those things happen by themselves, not because Ike was the guy going out in the battlefield, but because he was the guy that was thinking through what would happen if something else happened. And to be honest with you, that's exactly what you do in a poker game. I mean, right. I know that sounds funny, but it really is. It goes back to your thought process, how you're learning through things. One thing is that one of his first assignments after he left West Point, kind of like Olds, which was the last person to be a Triple Ace, Robin Olds. He actually became a coach for his local base for football. I mean, all of this stuff has to do with strategy. Everybody was understood that he had the ability to think through the problems all the way through. And again, coming back to the presidency, it does follow him all the way through where he was able to do that. In addition to that, he believed that it didn't matter who got credit as long as the job got done. And we talk about that all the time in hyperboles, but the truth is that's how you get successful in life in general, is that you don't care about where the credit goes. You just care if the job gets done. And being a leader is making sure other people feel important and people are respected. And most importantly, and this is something we forget today, is being heard. Because as much as we think about our own egos, it doesn't matter being in a leadership position. As long as if you have people that hear you and you're hearing them, you may not agree with what the decision is, but at least you've been heard, your point has been made, and then the next step can be taken.
Right. And I think that that's one of those qualities that, as far as what you just said, not wanting the credit, but wanting the job done. That's one of those qualities that people want in a leader, but aren't guaranteed in a leader, because so many people in politics want the credit.
And to be honest with you, again, if it wasn't from Kansas, I don't think you would have had the same type of thought process. It's a different world there, you know, back then, especially in Kansas. Very, very humble background. He knows that people need to be heard. This is his roots. You know, his mother was very religious. It was taught to him. But the most important thing is that he really believed that everybody's opinion mattered, and that we as individuals can accomplish some things, but us as a group can accomplish great things.
Right. And one thing interesting about Eisenhower, you have a figure who had worked and collaborated with just incredible figures of that time. Mentioned, you know, MacArthur, mentioned Marshall, and also with other presidents, you know, getting to know. I mean, it was FDR who put him to the task of D-Day, and then Truman and Kennedy and Nixon. What were those relationships like? And I specifically am very curious about your take on his relationship with Nixon. There's been so much written about that. And for you, it's for your family, it's a matter of family, since the Eisenhower and Nixon families are married, are related through marriage. So,
right. So Dick almost got replaced. President Nixon almost got replaced as vice president during the first term, but I decided not to. And for whatever reason, they're his own, it doesn't matter. But over the time, over the time that Ike was in office as president of the United States, Vice President Nixon at the time was an incredible instrument of getting things done. Whenever Ike was, for example, in the hospital, at Walter Reed, having a heart attack in 1955 was the first time they tried to pass the Interstate Highway Act, right, and defense. Which is our national highway system that we have currently. And it failed. It failed because they believed it was a states' rights issue, a 10th Amendment issue. Didn't matter if they quoted the Interstate Commerce Clause. It was a states' issue, states' problem, which at that time it took 14 days to get across the country. That's not very fast mobilization if we're invaded on one side or the other. That's a huge problem, in fact. Right. So Nixon, in 1956, Ike suffered a massive heart attack. For good reason. I think that some of the stuff you covered in some of your other podcasts, lots of pressure going on that was behind the scenes. But it was kind of interesting because it was actually Vice President Nixon at the time that had all the governors in town for the Council of the Governors and convinced them that it was important to have their congressmen and senators vote for a bill like this. So Nixon played a major role in some of the policies that happened under the Eisenhower administration, not to mention the fact that whenever Nixon later on became president, you know, he opened up China to us. He ended the Vietnam War. He was actually the last president to have a balanced budget. Anybody can argue with me with that, but I can show you the numbers, but it is actually what ended up happening. The relationship was interesting and the dynamics were interesting. But I think at the end, they became very, very good friends, very close, close enough where David married my Aunt Julie, the 70s. So it's pretty interesting whenever you go down those paths and see where those things go.
Right. Absolutely. I think it makes for such a fascinating contrast. You have the hero of World War II, and then you have this young, up and coming, controversial senator who has, you know, quite a track record. He was an attack dog. That's the phrase that I used. And one thing people talk about how Nixon was the first kind of modern vice president who had significant responsibilities, so much that he was debating Khrushchev. And yet they don't give the credit to Eisenhower for being kind of the first modern president to really empower his vice president.
Right. Well, there's, you know, Eisenhower's administration was the president of first. I mean, there's lots of things we can go down the list at some point in time if you want to. But the accomplishments that happened under the Eisenhower administration are pretty remarkable. We still feel them today. And Nixon had a major role in that. Nixon was absolutely doing things like debating Khrushchev, was absolutely involved in the politics and policies that were going on. 100%.
I once watched a documentary on Nixon. And it talked about the famous/infamous Checkers speech. And the point was that the narrator had made was that it was almost as if so the assumption was that Nixon would step down from the ticket, but he took the decision out of anyone's hands, including Eisenhower's, and asked the viewers to telegram, write letters to the Republican Party to keep him on the ticket. And it's this example of Nixon being shrewd. Is that true from what you've heard? And how did that all factor into their relationship?
So when I was in high school, I did a report on Nixon, you know, because I figured it would be pretty easy to do. And actually, it was actually very hard to do. My aunt was helpful, but for the most part, it was one of those things where you have to understand the man's dynamics and understand who he is and where it's from. President Nixon was a man with great ambition, but more importantly is he was very good at what he was doing and very, very, very smart. Probably always the smartest guy in the room. When he was in high school, he was the president of his high school, school. What is that called? What's the word I'm looking for? When he was in high school, the student body. He was the president of the student body. When he was in college, he was the president of the student body. When he went to Duke, he was the president of the student body. When he went to Duke Law, he was the president of the student body. The man only succeeded at what he did. And there's a reason for that. When you calculate, you think through things, you don't get to where you were at that age unless you're very good at what you do. And that speech is just a great example of someone that wanted to be on the ticket, understood that this was a historical moment. We were in the middle of one of the biggest non-battle battles that we've ever been. And we're talking the difference between fighting for freedom, fighting for our republic, fighting for a democracy type aspect of life, and fighting for communism and the idea of socialism, and that the government can tell you how you should spend your money and do what you're doing and what jobs to have. That is what was actually going on in Russia. The fact that Stalin killed more people than Hitler did is something that was known. We forget that. Mm-hmm. We forget that communism is one of the things, the leading causes of death of any political movement in the history of the world. I don't care what your social view is. That is factual. And, that's what we were at. That is the actual definition of what we have been fighting against since that time. And even today, we still fight against it. I mean, we pretend like we don't, but we do. It's the idea that we as people have inalienable rights, that the government cannot tell us that we are free. We are free automatically. And then you have a group of people that are oppressing those rights and one that are fighting to keep you free.
Right.
That's
right.
An important thing. So why would you want to leave that situation, especially with someone like Khrushchev in office? Because you got to remember the other side. Khrushchev was also on a crusade of righteousness as well, because whenever you're in the other side, taking the other's point of view, is that you're trying to ensure that people have equality and you're making sure that you have that. The problem with socialism and communism, my opinion, is throughout history, a very few people end up with the power, right? Marxist communism is great on paper, but once you implement it, someone has to implement it, and that person has the power. That's a problem.
Right. You know? The cult of personality and so on and so
Absolutely.
Forth.
Absolutely. The thing is if everybody was equal and everybody was the same and everybody thought the same way, it would work fine. The problem is that there's always one that doesn't think the same way.
Right.
And then power is cultivated and center-massed, right?
Exactly.
And then oppression happens. Anyways, right. That's a different conversation for a different day, I'm sure.
Sure. Well, but those issues were obviously what was going on that formed Absolutely. What Eisenhower was trying to do, and was the Cold War consensus, was that this is what we had to stop. And it's fascinating because Truman, he comes into office, end of World War II. And then the Cold War is this brand new war. And Eisenhower was really the first president that had to deal with the Cold War right from the start of his administration. So he is, Dean Acheson's book, President Creation, really could apply to that whole era, including Eisenhower. And of course, him and Truman, I think, were such a big part of what they were doing was creating U.S. leadership in that effort. And so in what ways do you think Eisenhower was really a different version of containment from his predecessor. How did he change the paradigm of that, especially since he had the solarium meetings and everything?
Well, see, the interesting thing about the Eisenhower administration is number one, if you think about it by itself, you think about when he left office, he was considered the moral compass of the country. Right. He was considered a do nothing president. He, you know, apparently he played more golf than he spent time in office. Right. How many times do we hear that today? Even it's kind of interesting to see. But in all fairness, he is in the World Golf Hall of Fame. So, I mean, so, yes, he did. He did play a lot of golf. But the thing is that you have to remember is that when he left office, he was ranked number 27. Right. Or so roughly. At the time, there were 34 presidents, so he was ranked very low as one of the worst presidents ever to lead, you know, to lead the country.
Which is, and I'm not saying this just because you're his grandson, great grandson, but it's pretty ridiculous that he was ranked that low. I mean, you know, but anyways.
But you got to remember that nobody really understood what was going on because he was playing golf and having meetings and working through. Everybody working through every other aspect of things. One time he said, you know what, don't worry about McCarthy because he's going to hang himself. And a year later he did. You know, he knew what was going on. He knew the aspects of things because he was calculated. He thought about it. He knew where people were going. He was a student of history, and that plays a major role. The Eisenhower administration is very unique in shaping the American ability of superpower, quote unquote. I hate that term because we're not a superpower. We are a very powerful country, yes, but we can't degrade other. Anyways, that's a different conversation. Again, a different conversation. But the importance is that at the time during the Cold War, we had a huge problem, right? So we had one. We had the idea of communism, socialism, the gross expansion of radical oppression. And I don't mean that in a negative way, but that's what it was. You have Poland being taken back over. You have people not giving up countries. You have invasions through Western Europe to certain points where there were battle lines drawn, just not executed. You have the Warsaw Pact. And then you know, you have NATO. So think about that for just a second. Today, we still have some of those same problems. The players are a little different, but the ideas are still the same. Instead of calling it a Cold War, we call it a cyber war. We call it something else. But there's still tension that goes on that stems all the way back to World War I and World War II. And China becoming a superpower is part of World War II and the aftermath of what happened with the vacuum of power with Russia collapsing, the Soviet Union collapsing into what it currently is. It's very fascinating when you take a holistic look.
Right, right. One thing that's fascinating to me, I mean, every few years, there's always some sort of confrontation with another country of some sort. And people always talk about this specter of, you know, tensions with North Korea are ratcheting up and, you know, and we were worried about their nuclear capability. And it happens every now and then. And there are all these fears that, oh, the president is provoking this and that. And you look at the Eisenhower years, and here was a president that was not afraid to walk to the brink, right to the brink. And it's funny because when people talk about a current president, you know, and this has been going on for more than, you know, the last 4 years, it's been going on for a while. But whenever there's a crisis, people talk about, oh, this president, they're bringing us into war and all that. And Eisenhower has this reputation for being this wise president and very much an earned reputation. And yet he was willing maybe to risk more than all the rest of these guys. So, you know, what made him willing to do that? And I think what can we learn about how presidents handle crises from what he did?
That's a great question. Think about it this way. When you're in World War II and you're going through and you're conquering back Europe and you're seeing cities at 90%, 95%, Warsaw, for example, 95% destruction, you're liberating concentration camps where millions of people were killed. You're coming across those things. You've already seen the worst of what humanity has to offer. and the fact that Truman did drop not one, but two atomic weapons, and the only person to do that in history. The rest of the world should have feared us at that point in time. We know Russia did. You know, we know that China did. We know that we understood that. But the reality is that it was a real threat to us as well. Whenever you're talking about the Bay of Pigs, you're talking about the Cuban Missile Crisis, you're talking about in May 1960, the U-2 spy plane being shot down. All of these things play a major role. Dulles says that we threatened North Korea and China if they didn't knock off their expansion, that we would soon eradicate them with nuclear weapons. I mean, these are all things that people talk about. Truth is that, you know, Ronald Reagan said it too, but you have peace through strength. That's what some people say. But at the same time, he was doing that. He was making sure that we as Americans, and not just Americans, but also Europeans and also Latin Americans and other people around the world were safe. He talked about peace. He talked about Atoms for Peace. You know, you're talking about the IAEA. You know, you're talking about speeches where he says that every bomb made, every bullet made, every warship launched is essentially a theft of people that are in poverty, that need food. So you have different messages going on. One hand, you're preaching, hey, I will do this if I have to, but don't force me because I want to do this over here. I'm a peaceful man. I've seen the worst. I'm not afraid of it. I know what it looks like, but we can do better together. And that's the thing that people forget. People to People International, for example, the organization I work for, was started in 1956 in the U.S. State Department. The idea that you and I, whoever's listening to this podcast, have the ability to sit down and reason with each other and take government out of it. Right. Because governments always have an agenda. Governments, victors of war, make boundaries while people do not. So it's something to consider, something to remember, is that once you break down those walls, those stereotypes, those types of things, very quickly you become friends. In 1962, we were sending people into occupied Germany. We still to this day go to Cuba. We've been invited to North Korea. We spent time with, go down the list of places that we were in. I was in the Gaza Strip last year in November, whenever they launched, the day after I left there, they launched 100 rockets into Jerusalem. I mean, my mom's been in bombings. These are things that we're fighting against because of the tyranny of people. Instead of understanding things, we're choosing to take the opposite route, right?
Right.
And so
right.
That's where Eisenhower was. Yes, I remember one time, I think, if I'm not mistaken, he threatened Khrushchev of putting back on the military uniform and leading forces into Russia. I think that was a conversation they actually had. So, yeah, no, he wasn't afraid of a fight, but he preferred not to have one. Again, his mother was a huge pacifist, and so was he, for the most part, walking contradiction of that side, but absolute true.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And I think when you bring up that he saw the worst in World War II, that's literally true. And I've read about how when he saw the Holocaust, essentially, when he saw the concentration camps, he wanted to, and there's a quote of him saying very clearly, we want this to be known. We didn't want anyone to be able to deny that this had happened.
In fact, he looked at my grandfather. John was his aide right after he got over. And he said, John, you need to take as many pictures as you possibly can, because one day people are going to say this never happened.
Right. Right.
And people today say it didn't happen, but we have albums and albums and albums showing it did.
I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of Warriors in Their Own Words, a podcast that presents the unvarnished, unsanitized truth of what we have asked of those who defend this nation. As a country, we need these stories more than ever. Stories from Americans who have borne the battle, including 30-year-old remastered interviews with veterans from World War I recounting their time in the trenches of Europe, and with veterans from World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and from our most recent conflicts in Iraq, Afghanistan, and other battlefields Americans may never have heard of. Hear their stories by listening to Warriors in Their Own Words wherever you find podcasts.
Hello, My name is Peter Zablocki, and I'm a historian, author, and college professor. I'm thrilled to invite you to check out Evergreen Network's History Shorts podcast. Every Tuesday and Thursday, join me on a journey through time, exploring the little-known and hidden gems of history. In each bite-sized episode, I'll dive into my original research to bring you intriguing historical curiosities you've probably never heard of, uncovering the fascinating stories that have shaped our world, from forgotten figures to overlooked events. And the best part? I've condensed all this historical goodness into manageable chunks, perfect for your on-the-go lifestyle. Whether you're commuting to work or squeezing in a quick break, History Shorts fits into the little time you probably think you don't have. Subscribe now and never miss an episode of the History Shorts podcast, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, I do want to talk more about PTPI since it's a big part of his legacy. What was Eisenhower like as a husband and as a father? You know, you hear about these figures, but you can know them on the resume, but not necessarily personally. What was he like, just from what you've heard?
Well, my mom gets asked this question quite a bit, and you know, I get asked about that with Nixon as well, and you know, other people. But the thing is, you don't know any different, right? My mom always says that there's three hats that Ike wore. He wore the general hat when he needed to. He wore the president hat when he needed to. But he always had the grandfather hat on whenever he was, you know, with them. In fact, in Gettysburg, which was the Eisenhower estate back then, people used to come in and land at Gettysburg through the helicopters, De Gaulle, Khrushchev, and, you know, name a world leader. They would land there. And all the grandchildren, all four grandchildren, my grandfather, my grandmother would all go over to the farm and have dinner. It was just a family affair with some guy that spoke a different language. No big deal, you know. And that's kind of how I remember it. I remember one story my mother told me was there was this mechanical bird that kind of moved around, right? And you wind it up and it moved around and all of this. And it was really, according to her, at the time she was about 5 years old. Remember, she was in the White House. It was the most amazing thing that ever happened, right? The most amazing thing. Hmm. And she'd wind up the bird and then she broke it. She broke it. And she was so worried that she would disappoint everybody. And so she hid it. And later on that night, she went and told her dad that she broke the bird, and she was very sad and very, very upset. And went over to her grandfather, and because it was his grandfather's, and gave it to him, said, "I'm so sorry, I broke this." And he goes, "Don't worry about it. Not a big deal. Here's another one." You know, and that's the reality of who the man was. You know, there was this one time, another great story is when she was about 6 years old, there was this, you remember those Tonka truck type things?
Oh, sure.
You know, right. Yeah. When those things actually started coming out in the late 50s, early 60s. And all the kids would go around the circle in the White House outside going around it. And they never let my mom do it because my mom was way too young at the time. And one time she had this opportunity. Everybody was doing something else, but she had her own service, the diaper, quote unquote, diaper detail with the people that took care of her, the Secret Service. And she got in the car and she started going. And then all of a sudden there was this foot that came up and stopped her and said, "What are you doing, young lady? You're speeding. You know, I need to write you a ticket." So I wrote a ticket and gave it to her. And she was really upset. Because there's two things that we don't do in the Eisenhower household, according to my mom. One, we don't lie. And two, we don't break the law. And she got a ticket for speeding. And she knew she was in trouble, in the deepest trouble. And so she threaded all day long, going back and forth. What am I going to do? What am I going to do? And she ended up having to go and tell her granddad that she spoke. And so it says, is there anything I can do? I broke the law. I'm so sorry. You know, I got a speeding ticket. He looked at it and goes, what am I going to do with this? He goes, I'll tell you what, you can't drive again for another 11 years. And that was the punishment, right? So that grandfather, it was just a grandfather. Of course, she couldn't drive again because she was five. She couldn't drive again for 11 years because she would be 16, of course. Right. Yeah. And she was all like, "Oh, man, that's I'm funny. Sorry, you know, all shucks." You know, and that's the reality of how things were. And it's just, you don't know the difference. A family life, it was just a good husband, loyal to his family, loyal to the country. But the man never lost his roots. When he was later on, when he retired from being president of the United States, he used to put on a wig and go show his cattle that he had at the Gettysburg Farm. And, you know, a couple of times, I think he won a blue ribbon, too. I'm not sure how, but, you know, they did. And it was a bad wig and they knew who he was. Of course, he won the blue ribbon. Right. So it's, that's just who he was. He loved to be outdoors, loved to fish, loved to hunt, you know, big Midwestern ideas.
Right. Now, his farewell address is one of the most famous American documents. It's, as you know, one of the most famous farewell addresses of all time. It's really his and Washington's that get talked about. It's quoted a lot by people on the right, by people on the left. What do people get right and what do people get wrong about the farewell address?
Oh, boy.
And I ask because, you know, people like to appropriate history for their own purposes often, and with the farewell address, it's no different.
So today, if you think about it, and I'll get back to that in just a second, but I have to give background so I can give you my answer properly. But today, if you think about it for 2 seconds, the United States is a completely different world than it was even 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20, especially 50, 60, 70 years ago, right? Mike was, the idea that he had was that we could be the beacon of hope and humanity. You got to remember that under the Eisenhower administration, there were so many things that happened that were monumental that had never happened in the history of mankind. One, we started the NASA program where we were shooting rockets up into space to compete with Russia, and not to mention the fact that we needed to do it anyways. Number two, we started the interstate system. You know, in 1919, when he went on his convoy for the first time across the country, it took him 62 days. By the time he left office, the project was underway, where now it's the greatest economic engine in the history of the world. Also the largest infrastructure project in the history of the world as well. The United States, that's not quite right anymore. But whenever you start thinking about it for 2 seconds, that was a 40-year project. So it got appropriated in 1956, but the last allocation of that was in 1996. It wasn't a fast spend. It was a long-term project that was paid for by taxpayers' money, right? How did he do it? The excise tax that we talked about earlier, it raised the excise tax in the United States from 1 penny to 2. So he doubled the excise tax in order to pay for the infrastructure project. Something that's unheard of today, right? He was able to expand the government by forming different agencies, new agencies, combining agencies, but at the same time, he was able to maintain fiscal responsibility. Operating in the black, last president to operate in the black, had 7 balanced budgets. Unbelievable. That's unheard of today. Could you imagine if today we actually could balance a budget? If we could get together along well enough to compromise, to have a good discussion, how much good we could do for the world? And that's what he did. He brought people to the table that were able to talk through problems. He figured that if you met somebody and you agreed with them 80% of the time, you probably could get something done. That's stuff that he learned throughout his whole entire life, all the way back to being a leader of the football team, being a captain at West Point, you know, getting through, graduating, that bringing camaraderie together, allowing people to work together was a way to solve problems. And he had the first civil rights bill passed since Reconstruction, for example. Would have been better, would have been much better if it wasn't for LBJ, but that's a different conversation for a different day. We can talk about that, you know, because I'm not going to beat up on LBJ, but that was one of those things where they were willing to go a lot further. But it's the important thing is that it happened, right? He was the last president to send the, you know, active army into a school, into a state to enforce federal laws. That's unheard of today. Could you imagine if Trump said, hey, I'm sending the 101 to Portland, what would happen? I mean, well, we already know it's not good, right? It's unbelievable how these things go. And you can agree with Trump or not agree with Trump, doesn't matter to me, but it was a different time. The accomplishments that you can list are enormous, but there was also failures too. I mean, there's lots of failures that happened along the way, but the biggest thing is that you have to remember the idea that we can compromise to work together to get something done and accomplished is the most important thing. And we were able to do that under the Eisenhower administration. I say we as the American people were able to do that. We had one of the best economies in the history of our country. We continued to grow. Technology expanded. People started getting TVs in their house. Doesn't sound like a big deal now, but that's a huge deal back then. Cars were coming more readily available. You have a second industrial revolution. And then all of a sudden, you have, you know, the continuation of Eisenhower's policies under the under the Kennedy administration, where you have more movement in the civil rights aspect. You have more NASA. And then the Bay of Pigs, other things that have happened. Some of that was part of Eisenhower's policy as well, but also at the same time, some of that was not. If you want to ask a direct question on that, I'm happy to answer it to the best of my ability.
Sure, yeah. Now, one thing I want to ask also is, and I've always been curious about this, is when you are part of a family that is as prominent as the Eisenhower family, when you're growing up, when does the talk happen? When does the talk happen where it's like, you know, your great-grandfather was the leader of the free world at one point, was the most important person on Earth. And also, that's not normal. Like, not because, you know, when you're growing up, your world is your world. And you just assume that, at least when I was growing up, you know, I just assume, well, this is the way all families are, right? But at what age does that, you know, become aware? Do you become aware, you know, wow, my great-grandfather was a really big deal, and this is a very unique, special thing, and my classmates, their great-grandfather wasn't president of the United States. How do you get aware? How do you understand that in a way that, you know, you kind of have that self-awareness of how special that is?
I don't think you ever really do. I mean, being honest, I am who I am. I believe that everybody's pretty much equal. And it doesn't really matter to me one way or the other. The thing is it's not who you're related to. It's what you do with what you're doing. People to People International, we're a 501c3 humanitarian world peace organization that does cultural exchange. We do things like HIV awareness in Tanzania for 150,000 at-risk women and children for HIV. We give them we provide sewing machines so that they can learn a trade so they don't have to do prostitution. And in other places, we put in water, clean water, hand washing stations. We do living libraries so we can educate people. We work and support all different types of things around the world to try to make the world a better place. Not to mention the fact that we get to also then travel to those places and meet the people that we're helping. I mean, that by itself is something that's amazing, because you realize for 2 seconds that it doesn't matter that my great-grandfather was President Eisenhower. What matters is what we're doing about it. What are we doing today? And today, more than ever, we need to make sure we have civility in this world. We need to make sure that we're leaving it a better place. Unfortunately for you and I, we've messed it up enough. We can only teach people to how to fix it and try to fix it. And every day you have an opportunity to do that. Every single day you have an opportunity to make the world a better place. And it's not only your responsibility as a person, as a human being, but you need to make sure you're tolerant, teach people that tolerance is a good thing. Make sure that you're not only doing that, but help people when you can. Could you imagine if everybody in the world did one act of kindness a day? That'd be 7 billion acts of kindness. If they did it for 100 days, it would be 700 billion acts of kindness. If they did it for 200 days, it'd be 1.4 trillion acts of kindness. Do you think the world would be a better place if we had 1.4 trillion acts of kindness over the next 200 days? I think so. And that's the legacy that Ike was teaching, is that we have a responsibility, an inherent responsibility, especially being from this country, to try to make the world a better place, continue to work hard, to strive to make a peaceful resolution. People say peace is impossible. I say peace is possible if you understand people. And understanding people is understanding culture, being tolerant, understanding who they are, what they need, and just acting in a way that's a manner that respects that. And I think if you can do that, you can be friends with anybody. And if I can be friends with you, I can certainly promote peace through that.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like a lot of the values that President Eisenhower used in his leadership has influenced you in your approach in your position with PTPI.
I would say my mom has, but you know.
Sure.
But no, it's
obviously it's not mutually exclusive, right?
Right. No, but the thing is that if you just stop for a second, there's madness going on all around us right now. we're talking about what's happening in this country, but we forget about the fact that there's one of the largest HIV problems going on in Tanzania. I'm just using that as an example because I alluded to it earlier. If everybody in the United States gave $10 to Tanzania for HIV awareness, we might be able to help eradicate that problem going on there. We get so bogged down in our own personal views and as individuals, this includes me, by the way, that we forget to take a step back and say, you know what? That could be that person's worst day they've ever had in their whole entire life. And we can work together to make that a better day for them. And all you got to do sometimes is open a door. And that's it. It's really simple. And if I can do that, you can do it, then everybody can do it. You know, it's walk a mile in someone else's shoes. Well, I'm never going to be able to do that unless I take time to understand where they're coming from.
Right. Now, my last question. So fairly or unfairly, presidents are often remembered for a specific thing.
Absolutely. You
know, Lincoln, Civil War, Washington, father of the country. What do you think Eisenhower would like to have been remembered for?
Golf. Definitely okay. Golf. No. See, the thing is that you got to remember in his administration, he gave credit to everybody else. He wasn't that type of person. I think history is being rewritten and written more and more about him is realizing, especially as the documents have been, opening up all the classified documents, that he was like a duck under, a duck in the water. He was able to, absolutely 100%, stay calm, have that calm front. But at the same time, there was a whole entire world that was on fire, just like today. He was able to contain communism. He was able to balance the budget. Those are all things that people will remind him of, that people will remember him by. But I honestly think that if you asked him directly, he would say, I want to be remembered for being a great grandfather and a great husband. And someone that was able to pull himself up from Abilene, Kansas, and become president of the United States. Because one of the things in one of his speeches, one of my favorite lines he ever said was, one of the proudest things that I've ever done, I can honestly say, is that I'm from Abilene, Kansas. He was always a Midwesterner. And I think if he can do it, I think the message should be everybody can do it. It doesn't matter who you are and where you come from, you can do it. And I think that's what he would be wanted to be remembered by.
Well, Merrill, thank you so much. Merrill Atwater, PTPI, great-grandson of our 34th president. We really appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Just real fast, anytime you can, go on ptpi.org, look at our website, 65 years almost. I'm the fourth Eisenhower to run it. Please get on. We do work on donations, so please feel free to donate. Come by, see us, call me. I don't care. I'll answer the phone. So I appreciate your time. Thank you so much for having me on today.
Well, thank you for being on. We appreciate.
Absolutely. And let's talk soon, okay?
Yes.
Thank you so much.
This American President is produced by myself, Richard Lim, and Michael Neal. If you like what you've been hearing, you can help us by leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to our show. We are a proud partner of Evergreen Podcasts. Please visit evergreenpodcasts.com for more shows you might enjoy. I'm Richard Lim. We're back next time with more This American President.
Around 10,000 BCE, families and tribes of the ancestors to the people of Britain would arrive in the southern part of the island after crossing from land that bridged from Europe. The Welsh built houses, communities, kingdoms, and continued to survive through Romans, Saxons, Danes, and Normans. The language and culture influenced by these sources continued to change and thrive, becoming ancient and modern at the same time. Join me as we travel through the history, meeting the kings, queens, nobles, and everyday people that create and grew modern Wales from the seeds of the ancient past. Creoso, and welcome to the Welsh History Podcast.